Hey guys, it's Elena.
And it's Candace.
And you're listening to Cousins on Crime. Candace?
I'm great. How are you doing? I'm sorry if I sound like a telemarketer right now, but I'm using a different setup. Not new, not like I've changed over, but just for the time being.
Yeah. Just for maybe this episode and the next.
Yeah. Hopefully.
We're a little discombobulated today.
Yeah. I guess we could tell people why.
If you want to, are you ready?
I'm ready, I think.
Go for it. I'll let you.
So I'm moving to Texas to be with Lena. So everything is in disarray. My house is partially packed, and so bear with us. Thanks for being understanding that we were off last week.
Yes.
We just needed a minute. You know?
Yeah.
So we're really excited.
I'm excited. I can't wait to have you here and we can record in the same place.
I know. Won't that be cool?
I can come over and help you get the girls down for bed.
Oh, that would be great. And then I'll be on time every night if you do that.
I think we're pretty much on time when we say we're going to meet. So
most of the time.
You're a man of your word. And I like that.
Oh, man. Well, how are you doing, Lena?
I'm okay.
Yeah.
I've been having a lot of back pain,
because
I'm old.
Yeah.
That's what happens
when we get getting old.
Yeah. And I don't have time to slow down.
No.
So, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like when I broke my toe packing the house up, and I was like, well,
gotta keep going.
I can't just rest my foot right now. But yeah, so is it like your lower back, upper back?
Yeah, my lower back. Mm-hmm. Yeah, both of my parents have had multiple back surgeries, and I refuse.
So yeah.
We'll see. I just keep praying that God would heal me. Anyway.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, though. Once you have one back surgery, it's like are you going to have another one at some point?
Yeah. That's what I hear. And that's what I've experienced with my parents. So we'll see how long I can go.
Well, someday, maybe in our day, when we get really old, they'll have exoskeletons we can wear to get around.
That would be interesting.
To be honest, I kind of need one of those right now. So
yeah, I'm not gonna lie.
Hopefully, somebody's actively working on that.
Oh, I'm sure there's.
I mean, I know there are exoskeletons, but can they commercialize them soon?
Very soon.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to hear about your case.
Okay. Well, we can go ahead and get into it.
Yeah. Tell me what it's about.
So, a couple of people in our family have suggested this one, and my dad reminded me of it. And so I was like, I'm just going to do it.
Okay.
So, trigger warning. There is quite a bit of mention of sexual assault. So, if you don't want to listen, I don't blame you. Mm. We're talking about Retha Stratton.
Okay.
Have you heard of her?
The name sounds familiar.
Okay. So she grew up a quiet little girl, but by the time she turned 18, she decided she wanted to do what her friends were doing and become a cheerleader.
All right. Rah, rah, sa-thumba.
Crank it up to loppy.
Hey, side note, if you guys are good which you are. Maybe someday me and Lena will do Crank It Up Chalopy for you, like, and post it on our Instagram.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm down for it. I've already taught my nieces, and they do it all the time, and they've shown their friends.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So,
I wonder if Rita knew Crank It Up Chalopy.
Oh, back in that day? I'm sure she did. But she was strong-willed, confident. She was a beautiful 18-year-old woman. She was a cheerleader at Castleberry High School in River Oaks, Texas, which is a suburb in Fort Worth. She was blonde and gorgeous. Her father, AJ, was a salesman, and her mother, Alta, I think she actually went by Doris, was a hairdresser in the small town, and Rita had a sister named Rana. I'm not sure if you know, but in small town Texas, Friday night football and basketball was and is a big thing. The community comes together and watches the high school boys play, and then there are the cheerleaders. Most of the football guys and the cheerleaders were friends, and they had lived close to each other and grew up together, so a close-knit community. Rita was dating an older guy named Dale, and she had just moved out of her family home at 18 years old.
Wow.
And she moved into a home with her friend Amy Moody. Even though River Oaks had always been a safe place to live, Rita's dad was adamant that they be careful at all times and pay attention to their surroundings. You see, there had been a series of sexual assaults in the area, and Rita's response was basically, "Daddy, he'll never rape me. He'll have to kill me first."
Oh, Rita.
So she was a fighter. She, like I said, she was stubborn, strong-willed. So she was like, "I don't think so."
Yeah.
But they, just like everyone in the town, started locking their doors, when really it wasn't a big deal to leave the door unlocked before these attacks. They weren't living in fear, they were just being cautious. So jumping to January 21st of 1982, it was a Thursday. Amy had just gotten off work and drove home. It was 6 p.m., and she said when she arrived home, everything was dark, and it was raining outside. The door was open when she walked up to the front door, and she felt that something just wasn't right. She reached her hand in and turned on the light and walked into the home that she shared with Rita. The first thing that she noticed was blood everywhere.
Oh my God. Can you imagine?
No.
Oh.
I could not. So she said there was blood on the floor, on the walls, the lamps. She called out for Rita with no answer. She went next door where her sister was staying and told her what was going on. So her sister grabbed a bat and they went back to the house. They walked into the living room and followed the blood trail and walked into Rita's room.
Oh, no.
They saw Rita laying bloody and lifeless in her closet with a kitchen knife sticking in her chest and her panties stuffed in her mouth.
Oh my gosh.
She had been stabbed 38 times and her wrists were slit.
Mm.
Amy called the police and they quickly came. Dennis Timmons was the lead investigator, and he did notice that there were no signs of forced entry, so surely it was someone that she knew. Dennis saw that Rita put up a fight. She had obvious defensive wounds. She had cuts in her hands indicative of her grabbing the knife at some point. Rita's family was called and they all showed up at Rita's house, including Dale, Rita's longtime boyfriend, looking for answers while the investigation is getting started. Detective Timmons questioned and quickly ruled out Amy and Dale as suspects. Rana and Dale had gone back to Rita's house after the questioning to check on the investigation, see how it was going. And a girl that that they knew, or that Dale knew, was across the street. She called both of them over to her and told them that she had driven by Aretha's house about 5 or 6 p.m., the same time that they figured that the murder happened. She said that she saw a red truck parked up on Skyline Drive, and it was really an odd place to be parked. Ronna said, "Well, who drives a red truck?" And Dale and this girl looks at each other, and they both respond with, "The only person I know that drives a red truck is Wesley Miller." Aretha had already mentioned his name to Ronna just recently, telling her that Wesley's name had come up in the sexual assault cases that were happening. Early the next morning, detectives started canvassing the area, asking neighbors if they had seen or heard anything. One neighbor said yes, she saw the red truck parked on Skyline. It was not there before 5 p.m., and it was not there after 6 p.m. Around 9 p.m. that Friday, police received an anonymous tip that Wesley Wayne Miller's girlfriend, Roxy, had washed Wayne's bloody jeans the night of January 21st, which was the night of the murder. And just to point out, Roxy is another Castleberry cheerleader.
Oh.
That night was actually Roxy's birthday, and when Wayne walked into Roxy's house, her parents were there and asked what in the world happened. He had blood all over his pants. He says he was playing football and one of his teammates got a bloody nose and bled on him.
How brazen. He just walks in front of a bunch of people covered in blood.
Yeah.
Wow. Like,
oh, football injury. Here, wash my jeans.
Okay.
So when Roxy was questioned, she said Wesley had shown up at her house at 5:45 or 5:50. And her house was actually just about a 3-minute drive from Aretha's.
Ay, ay, ay.
Wesley was arrested around 3 a.m. Saturday morning. And when he was questioned, he showed no emotion. Shocker. He says, "I'll talk about it."
Thanks.
He sat there quiet and then said, "I'll talk about it." He says he and Aretha actually arranged a meeting for him to come over to her house.
I'm so sure.
Right. Something happened and they started to fight. And he said he grabbed a knife and just lost his mind. Detective Timmons asked, "Well, why did you cut her wrists?" And he gave an immediate answer saying, "Oh, I just wanted to make sure she was dead."
Okay. That's... whatever. Yeah,
no remorse. The community and the group of friends could not make sense of this. Wesley was a star athlete, and he was the captain of the Castleberry High School football team.
Wow.
He won all-around senior at the school, and this was their friend. He was dating the girl's friend, Roxy, and he was known to be a quiet guy. It couldn't be him. So, there had already been a series of sexual assaults in the area, in and around the area. And now the attacks were clearly escalating to murder. A year before Aretha's murder, January 1981, the first known victim, Susan Brown, was a junior in the 11th grade and a cheerleader at Castleberry High School. She lived in Lake Worth, so she wasn't super close with the others, but on a Friday night, their basketball team was playing against Boswell High School.
Okay, Pioneers.
And the Castleberry cheerleaders were set to be there. Susan never showed up. One of the other cheerleaders, Roxy, was supposed to pick Susan up and go to the game. Roxy showed up without Susan. Roxy had gotten into a fight with her boyfriend, Wesley, and arrived late to the game. The cheerleading team was frustrated with Susan and felt that she wasn't taking the team seriously. They would later find out that Susan had been sexually assaulted that same night. Susan says around 7 p.m., a man called her house and asked to speak to Mr. Brown. And Susan said, "No, he's not here," and the man hung up. A few minutes later, Susan's sister called, and when Susan was talking to her, a man came into her home wearing pantyhose over his face. He did not have a shirt on. He was wearing jeans with the button and zipper open.
Ew.
She dropped the phone and ran through the house, but he caught her and attacked her. She prayed out loud for God to send his angels to protect her. She noticed that he had difficulty getting an erection, but when he was done, he told her to turn over onto her stomach so that she wouldn't see him, and he left. She said maybe he realized that the phone was off the hook and someone may have heard what was going on, but he ended up getting up and leaving out of the house. She quickly got up, locked the door, and looked out the window. She saw that the guy parked his car in front of a vacant lot down the street and could see the tail lights as the car drove away. When she told the police what happened, they never even did a rape kit on Susan. Yeah. But she was able to tell police that the attacker was around 18 to 24. He was 5'8 or 5'9 and a stocky build. They eventually asked her to pick a person out of a lineup, but there was just no way she could recognize the attacker due to the pantyhose distorting his face. Susan went back to school the next Monday.
Oh my gosh. So this happened
Friday, and she goes back to school Monday.
Why didn't they do rape kit?
It was not explained.
80s, like, and it was just...
Yeah, 1982, or this was 81. So she goes back to school the next Monday, and the police told her that it could have been someone that she knew and told her to be looking around to see if she could put two and two together. So
okay,
to speak.
That's disgraceful. Like, Susan, solve your own case.
She's
traumatized. And...
Yeah.
Oh, that's too soon. That's too soon. The Monday afterwards. Oh.
So, and she explains how she went back to school and she just was numb and, you know, she wasn't her cheery self. She's a cheerleader. She's supposed to be cheery. And she just kind of was in a daze and people would come up to her and be like, "What's wrong?" At this point, nobody knew what happened.
Oh,
she didn't
want
to tell.
I was about to ask you if her cheerleader friends were like still pissed at her.
They were mad at her and they were giving her grief and talking about her. But the cheerleading coach or one of the leaders told them, "Look, something bad happened to her. Y'all need to cool it."
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So she says during the games, she would be looking in the stands like and looking at people like, "Is someone watching me?" Like just trying to figure out who it was. However, when Retha was murdered and Wesley was arrested, it all made sense to her.
Oh, my gosh.
The build, the mannerisms. She knew it had to be Wesley. The morning of November 11th of 1981 in Saginaw, Texas, 19-year-old Lynn was home. Her parents left for work and her siblings left for school. It was before 8:15 a.m. Lynn stayed home in bed. She wasn't feeling good that day. Around 8:20 a.m., Lynn's phone rang in her bedroom. She had her own separate line, phone
cool.
line from the family.
Was it like a clear Lynn, like a clear
I
phone?
Don't know.
That would have been. I bet it was.
I know. Were those in the 1980s?
I was about to say
that
maybe that's the 90s.
But her bedroom phone rang, and when she answered the phone, or the man on the phone asked her if so-and-so was there. It was a name she didn't know. She told him that no such person lived at that address and hung up the phone. A couple minutes later, the family telephone rang. It was the same guy asking for a different person with a different name. Once again, Lynn told him no one lived here by that name, and eventually Lynn went back to bed and fell asleep. A few minutes later from that, she woke up to find a man in a white athletic shirt kneeling by her bed.
Ew.
He was wearing a nylon stocking over his head to mask his facial features. He had her phone cord in his hand and was yanking it from the wall. Lynn yelled out, "What are you doing?" And he began to attack her. The attacker told her that he had been stalking her for a while and asked her if she was a virgin.
Oh, gross. None of your business. Yeah.
When he was finished, he made Lynn roll over onto her stomach and told her not to move. As he was leaving, he warned her not to tell anyone about the assault, or he would come back and finish her off. He left through the sliding patio door, and Lynn immediately ran into her parents' room and locked the door. She called the police and reported the assault, but the police were unable to find the attacker. December 7th of 1981, Lisa Tickner was also assaulted in her home. Lisa was a friend to Retha and a cheerleader with Retha. Lisa had just arrived home from working at a local grocery store. She worked the late shift and got off at midnight. Lisa's mother was sitting in the den. Her mother was in the end stages of a degenerative disease, so she was severely disabled.
Oh no.
She was aware of her surroundings, but she was unable to move.
Oh my god.
Lisa had fallen asleep in her room. She was woken up by the sound of her door opening. All she could see was a man wearing jeans and a shirt and a mask. He jumped on top of her and attacked her, and then told her to turn over onto her stomach. He got up and walked out of her room, and as she went out of her room to check on her mother, she got a glimpse as he walked past her mother without a care in the world. And before he walked out of the house, she saw he took his mask off and he had medium-length dark hair. And that fits the description of Wesley. He had medium-length dark hair. Lisa immediately called a friend and told her what happened. That friend told Lisa not to shower and said, "I'm coming to get you," and took her to the hospital. Mm. So even though I say that matches the description of Wesley, Lisa didn't see his face. So she didn't know. She couldn't say it was Wesley. On December 8th, the day after Lisa's attack, Roxy's little sister was also attacked. When Lisa heard about it, she went over to Roxy's house. They had just lived across the street from each other.
Oh my gosh.
And they compared notes. The man sounded the same. He wore jeans, same color and style of shirt, and wore a mask over his head, and told both of them to roll over on their stomach when he was done. A month later, a woman was attacked at a laundromat. When the guy was done, he told her to roll over and left. And this is when it all got too real. I mean, girls started sticking in groups and being more cautious.
This is wild to me. The amount of sexual assaults that were going on.
And this is all within a year.
And the brazenness of it. Like, just going into their home. Like, he must have obviously knew these people, knew that their parents were, like, this girl's mom was disabled. The dad was probably at work, you know, just he probably knew the patterns. How brazen.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah. Well, he kept getting away with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it, they say it escalates at that
Absolutely.
Point. Absolutely. Well, it did. So each surviving girl had told detectives that the guy had worn a mask, but they gave a description of the guy's build. Even a couple of them said that he had a hard time getting an erection and that his penis was really small.
Why didn't Roxy say, I know that guy?
I don't know. I mean, I guess whenever they've got a mask on and, you know, the face is distorted, it's like, and when that's happening to you, I think it just kind of like you blank out. I don't know.
Yeah, but Roxy was, that was her boyfriend. Yeah. She was probably like, wait a minute, that sounds familiar. Small penis, yeah. Can't get it up, you know, like.
I don't know. It didn't say, I don't know if Roxy had ever had sexual relations with him. So, I mean, you would think that he would try with his girlfriend, or maybe he was trying with all these other girls. And
maybe he did try with her and she wouldn't have sex with him.
I don't know. That was never, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't want to get into her personal mm-hmm. business, but. So as they were investigating Retha's murder, they see this picture of her with the group of cheerleaders at Castleberry High School. And they see the girls' faces that were sexually assaulted within the last year, all in the same picture. It was as though they were being picked one by one. And they knew it had to be someone close to them. So after questioning Wesley, he ultimately confessed and was charged with Retha's murder. He pled guilty to the charges and made a plea deal. The other sexual assaults were not allowed to be brought into court and to allow the jury to hear and see the whole picture of who he really was. He was sentenced to 25 years in prison.
What?
But there was one sexual assault that he was charged with, and that was the one in Saginaw. So for that one, he got a concurrent sentence of 20 years. So concurrent meaning the 20 years that he's spending for the sexual assault case goes along with the 25. It's not like he's going 25 right. And then he
not consecutive gets
another 20 after.
Why that one, did it say?
The only thing that I could see that suggested why only that one is because there was one fingerprint that they could use to solve the case in that. I mean, you would think they would have plenty of DNA, but I mean, it was the early 80s at that point. So between 1992 and 2018, Wesley was released on parole something like 6 times.
What?
Each time he went right back to prison for violating parole.
Oh, why not?
Yeah. Yeah. 10 years later, he was again released for good behavior and then sent right back. Each time he was sent back because he refused to participate in sex offender counseling or was accused of committing another crime, including stalking a woman in Wichita Falls.
Okay, no, absolutely not.
Yeah. So when Wesley was 45, he had to transfer jails for having a relationship with a 21-year-old female jailer.
Oh, for the love. Ew. Honey.
I know.
Have you read his rap sheet? Oh, Lord. Yeah,
I don't know. So... ultimately, he was later civilly committed under the state's Sexually Violent Predator Program and will remain on mandatory supervision in prison.
Good.
So that's where forever? He is today. For supposedly forever. That report was in 2022, a year ago. So let's just hope it stays that way.
I tell you, oh, just wait till my case next week. This is just, it makes me so mad. Why does it have to take 6 times?
It doesn't have to.
For you to, for them to prove their deviance. Like, I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes me mad.
Yeah.
Well, thank God he didn't murder anyone else. I mean, that we know of.
I mean, but that was a lot. I mean, I'm glad he was put away. And you know, as in the natural, we try to think, like, why would something like this happen? Like, what was the purpose of this? And if we want to think about Reatha's murder that way, like, what was the purpose of it? I mean, to put him away, if that's any justice, but that doesn't, I don't know if that makes it
better. I'm sure it isn't for her family, but we have the luxury of looking at it that way, saying big picture, you know, maybe he had to commit this heinous murder to stop raping everyone in the area. And of course he would have kept doing that. He would have kept doing that. He probably would have murdered more people.
Absolutely.
But Reatha probably beat him up. That's why they stab her so many times.
Yeah. As I was researching this story, I was like, have we done this story before? And I'm like, oh, what I'm thinking of is Pee Wee Gaskins, how it just kept
how it just like, yeah, exactly. Oh, Lord. Mm-hmm. That was terrible.
Yeah.
That was terrible. I need a shower now.
Yeah.
My heart is with all the women who are the survivors of his sexual assaults. And I know that he's put away.
Yeah.
But there's something about having someone pay for the crime they committed against you.
Yeah.
And, you know, we find this in a lot of our cases. They may be tried for one murder, and then there's not enough for the others. And then prosecutors say, well, be glad he was convicted for this murder. But there's just something about having your name. You know what I mean? Like, your name in the mix. Like, he's paying for the crime against me.
Right.
So, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
You know, we grew up near the area, so I remember hearing her name. I think I learned of that case when I was a teenager.
Yeah. Yeah, that was tough. Just actually a few years before we were born, so.
Yeah, I think my mom was their age.
Oh, I'm sure. We have family that knows a couple of the people in the story. So, I'm sure your mom knew of her at least. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And my mom was real big into sports, so she probably played their team and stuff. So, well, rest in peace, Reath.
Yes.
That was great, Lena. Let's do it again sometime.
All right, let's do it. Bye, y'all.
See you next week. Bye.
Well, thank you for listening to Cousins on Crime. If you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating so that other true crime fans can find us.
If you have any case suggestions or just want to say hey, email us at cousinsoncrime@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Instagram, where we post case photos and information at Cousins on Crime Podcast.